If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, May the 29th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow, and joining me today in studio here on the campus of Stanford University, Dr. Amy Ziegert. She's a Davies Family Senior Fellow here at the Hoover Institution and co-director of Stanford's Center for International Security and Cooperation. She's also a Stanford Professor of Political Science by courtesy and a contributing editor to The Atlantic. And if you've seen her on TV of late, that's because she's co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice, the title of which is Political Risk: How Businesses and Organizations Can Anticipate Global Insecurity. And that's our topic for today, Businesses, Global Insecurity. Amy, thanks for having me back. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
So, before we get into the book, let's talk a bit about how Amy Ziegert becomes Amy Ziegert, because I'm always curious with Hoover Fellows as to how they landed on their particular path. You write about global insecurity. You've written in the past about the CIA, the NSC, origins of 9/11. Have you always been drawn in that direction, or is that something that you gravitated toward as you went through your studies?
So I think I've always been interested in why good organizations do dumb things. In my previous life, I was a McKinsey & Company management consultant, so I looked at why even great companies often didn't know what challenges they were up against and had needed help to figure them out. And that's true in the intelligence community, too. So I've always been interested in that, and I've always also been interested in how we think about thinking. So you'll see in the book there's a lot about analysis and cognitive pitfalls. Why don't more companies understand or see political risk coming? So those have been two long passions of mine.
Right. And your education, you attended Harvard and then graduate school at Stanford.
Yes. And so I wandered into a class my first year of graduate school taught by this professor named Condoleezza Rice with another professor named Terry Curl. And the story was it was supposed to be the hardest class in the doctoral program at Stanford. So I wanted to see what this hard class was all about. Mm-hmm. And these two professors had and still do have very different political views. So I thought if these two women could teach a class together, I really wanted to see what that must be like. And I walked into class and I was hooked.
You're hooked. And now you've written a book with her.
Yes. So Condi was my doctoral advisor, and it's for the past 6 years we've been teaching this class together in the business school about political risk, and now we've written a book together, which makes me feel great and I think makes her feel a little old.
So is it fun to work with the former professor? I guess it's payback. You can now correct all her words and tell her what she's done wrong or writing. And
well, you know, it will come as no surprise to you, Bill, that one of us is much more diplomatic than the other. And so in the process of writing the book, it was a very natural collaboration since we've been in the classroom together for 6 years. So we've been playing with these ideas for a long time with our students. But it was a very useful collaboration for me because my writing is much more diplomatic now than it used to be.
I think of all the words said to her in her life, the word she's probably never heard are "try to keep up with me." Right. So
exactly.
The book is an extension of classes that you and Secretary Rice have taught over at GSB. It's PolyCon 584. Is that the course?
That's it.
That's right. And you have about, what, 30 students in that class?
We do. We wanted it to be highly interactive. And
right.
So every year we only have about 30 students. And when we first started teaching the course, we looked around to see what materials we could assign, as professors normally do. Mm-hmm. And we really couldn't find anything that we wanted to assign. And so we created a research team, and we developed our own simulations and cases. And so at the end of the class every year, the students come to us and they tell us two things.
Right.
One is you need to make the course longer. Students never tell you they want the course to be longer. So that was a pretty interesting indicator that there was more to this. And the second thing they kept telling us was, you know, you really need to turn this course into a book.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've dedicated the book actually to our students who prodded us to go down this path.
And when you get to pick your student. In other words, you have 30 in your class. There are going to be more than 30 people applying. So do you interview students for the class?
So we don't. At the Graduate School of Business, the approach is that students should go through a lottery to get into courses, and they have a priority system where they can use certain points to get into the lottery. But we actually don't choose the students who go into the class. We teach the students that make it through the lottery.
And there's a certain profile of the students in the class, have you found, or do you think they're going to be like you and 10, 15 years, or is this just sort of random selection?
Well, One of the great things about the business school is that more than a third of the students are not from the United States. So right. We get a wide cross-section of students from all sorts of different countries and backgrounds. It's a little bit of a skewed sample in the sense that they're interested in political risk.
Right.
We probably have more students who have had experience in government as opposed to the average business school student. Mm-hmm. But one of the great things about teaching the class is we get just an incredibly eclectic group of students with different perspectives.
Right. Right. It is, by the way, one of the most fascinating people watching places on the campus if you go to that cafeteria at lunchtime, because you have people from different walks of life, different age groups, different backgrounds. It's fascinating to watch them all blend.
And it's wonderful to have them in the classroom. They're not shy either,
no.
So that makes for a good conversation.
So once upon a time, Amy, companies made rather simple calculations about their business operations based on concepts like taxation, regulatory climate, threat of expropriation, things like that. I think back to McDonald's, for example. McDonald's first opened in the Soviet Union on January the 30th, 1990, and it was a splash when it opened. People lined up around the block to buy McDonald's food. Factory workers would typically have to spend 4 days' worth of their salary just to get burgers, fries, and a couple of shakes, but they wanted it. In 2014, Amy, McDonald's had a problem in Russia. It was closed. It was closed briefly for, quote, health and safety violations, as the Russian officials call it, but you're nodding your head because you know what the issue is. That's because basically they were retaliating. The Russians were against the U.S. launching sanctions against Russia over the actions in Ukraine. It's a different world now than it was in 1990, and it's not just a Cold War we're thinking about. We're thinking about a more complicated war, which is defined by security challenges, terrorism, cyber threats, insurgencies, and so forth. So here's the question. As a business that wants to have worldwide operations, we sit here in Silicon Valley, Facebook, Google, Apple, and the like, they're worldwide entities. How do they go about being global thinkers?
Well, that's a big question. Let me take the first part of your question first, which is how has risk changed?
Yes.
So we spent a lot of time in the book thinking through this and a lot of time talking about it. You're exactly right that 30 years ago, it really was about, is this dictator going to nationalize my assets?
Right.
But even if you think about great power conflict today, that looks very different. Geopolitical risk looks very different today than it did during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. So you give this great McDonald's example. Think about Facebook, a company close to home. Who would have ever imagined that Facebook's biggest challenge is a great power behaving badly, Russia, interfering in the U.S. presidential election and sowing distrust in our democratic system? That's what Mark Zuckerberg has to worry about now. So even though we have the same kind of great power circumstance, the nature of political risk for a company like Facebook is really different. But you asked, how can companies that want to go global think about risk? The short answer is, like politics being local, risk is local too. So we do not have a magic silver bullet answer that you should think about these three things or do these five things.
Right.
But we do suggest that companies really need to understand first, what's their risk appetite? How much risk are they willing to accept for the return that they want to get? Because those two things have to go hand in hand. And second, what are the local concerns that they might have? What's the mayor of the town think about? What are the local movements? What are the transnational actors? What about that lone citizen with a Twitter account or a Facebook account that's going to post something that could go viral and come back to bite you if you're a corporate leader? So the nature of risk is fundamentally different, and companies need to have a systematic process for first understanding their own risk appetite, and second, for analyzing risk and mitigating the risks that they can.
Right. So you've broken this down to three categories. First, as you said, is analyzing risk. The second would be reducing risk exposure. The third would be responding to risk. And there's a great line that your quote is saying. You said, quote, nobody gets credit for fixing problems that never happened.
Yeah, that's one of the things we found. And we talked to a number of CEOs and investors and others, and we look at a wide range of different industries, including the defense establishment,
right,
where we both have spent a lot of time thinking about and observing, and in Conti's case, actually, being in a senior position of government.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody gets rewarded for stopping bad events from happening. That's true whether you're in the intelligence community. That's true if you're a risk person in a corporation. And so the challenge for a CEO or a board is, how do you reward people? How do you put money and invest into capabilities that don't pay obvious dividends to your business? So one example we use in the book is FedEx.
Right.
FedEx is a great company. They fly this ghost plane every night from Denver to Memphis to their super hub. It's an empty plane most nights. It costs a lot of money for FedEx to fly this plane. Why do they do it? Well, they do it because they want to make sure that if any package is left behind, it gets picked up by that spare plane and it gets delivered to the super hub in Memphis. Because Fred Smith, the founder of FedEx, told us he knows that he's not in the business of delivering packages. Right. He's in the business of delivering trust. That's a cost. And he's invested in that capability because he knows it matters. So corporate leaders need to understand that.
You told a story about FedEx in your book that hit home. In April 2010, I was actually about to go to Europe and get on a plane, and I had a problem. There's a volcanic eruption in Iceland. Why does this matter to flying to Europe? Well, simply because airplanes don't fly through volcanic ash. British Airways had a plane in 1982, I think it was, Amy, that was flying in Indonesia, and it flew through a cloud of volcanic ash, and all four engines on the plane shut down. So since then, jet airliners have come to the conclusion not a good idea to fly through volcanic eruptions. This volcano erupts in Iceland, and it shuts down air traffic. It was the largest air traffic shutdown since World War II. FedEx has to adjust the situation. FedEx, as you write about in the book, actually had anticipated a crisis like this occurring.
So FedEx lives political and natural risk every day. Right. So they say they may not know when a trucker strike is going to happen in Europe, but they know it's going to happen.
Right.
They may not know that an Icelandic volcano is going to erupt, but they always have a plan B. Mm-hmm. They have this global operations center with hundreds of people staffing it, meteorologists, risk managers, experts in a variety of different areas. And right. their whole mission is to figure out how to get the package delivered on time no matter what happens. And something else that Fred Smith did that I think is very, very wise is he doesn't just have risk management at the ground level. Mm-hmm. His whole company thinks about managing risk all the way up to the board of directors. He noticed years ago that he was serving on other boards and cybersecurity became a bigger challenge to these other boards.
Right.
And he thought ahead and he thought, you know, I need that kind of expertise on my board at FedEx. And so he was one of the early people to bring in real cybersecurity experts like Chris Inglis from the National Security Agency to help FedEx understand and mitigate, as you mentioned, mitigate the threat of
right.
that cyber attacks will disrupt the business.
Now, are you telling me that as we speak, there's somebody sitting in FedEx, their hub's in Memphis, right?
Yes.
There's somebody sitting in Memphis or wherever they war game these things, and they're sitting there saying, okay, a 6.8 earthquake hits in LAX tomorrow or SFO. That airport is shut down. What do we do? Are they always thinking in these scenarios and planning for these contingencies?
So they use a variety of different tools and techniques to try to imagine the unimaginable. So
right.
one of the things that we talk about in the book is that there are lots of different ways, but companies need to pick some mm-hmm. to figure out what are the possible drivers of risk and how do we think about those so that we can withstand the sort of risk disaster if it happens.
Right.
So some of that is scenario planning. Some of that is one company we found called Paychex does. I'm a basketball fan, and so we put this in the book, a tournament of risk, a March Madness kind of tournament of risk, where leaders in the company have to actually suggest what risks are going to go head-to-head in their bracket matchup, and they actually have 64 slots for the brackets. So companies do it in a variety of ways, but FedEx is a leader in that they're always thinking that something could go wrong because somewhere in the world it does.
Okay, so let's use the basketball analogy. What would be a Final Four right now? If you're a corporation, international corporation, Amy, what is your Final Four right now of risk?
I think it depends on the company. I know that's a very unsatisfying answer.
Right.
But for example, if you're an oil and gas company, mm-hmm. you've got a lot of below ground risks, the geologic risks that you're really worried about. You don't have a whole lot of say about what the above ground risks are going to be.
So deep water horizon, something like that.
Right. Or right. you think about, Condi tells the story about, you know, she was on the board of Chevron, how she right. said at one point to the CEO of Chevron, is it true that oil and gas is found only in unstable countries? And his answer was, yeah, like Santa Barbara, California, which is the only concession they've actually never been able to realize
right.
Off the coast of Santa Barbara. So oil companies have to make long tail investments and they have to deal with some pretty unsavory regimes.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to worry so much about how consumers are going to react because most of us don't think about where the oil is sourced when we go to the gas station.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a company like Disney, a consumer-facing company,
mm-hmm.
you care a lot about that reputational risk. So Disney's never going to set up shop in northern Iraq, right, or in Venezuela.
Right.
So the risk profile for Disney is going to be very different by the nature of the industry that they're in.
If you're Facebook or Apple, you're looking at what, intellectual property laws, government control, regulations, things like that?
So if you're Facebook or Google or Twitter, one of these big tech companies, you're mm-hmm. looking at privacy regulations
right.
like the GDPR, the European privacy regulations that just
mm-hmm.
came into effect over the weekend. You're looking at the cybersecurity of your systems, your networks in other countries. You're looking at consumer attitudes, too, and the cascade risks that a behavior or activity in one place can have on your business elsewhere. Because what happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas anymore when it comes to political risk. Political risk becomes global pretty fast.
Okay. You also tell the tale in the book about Marriott. Marriott Corporation, and the anecdote you tell is about a gentleman named Alan Orlob. On July 16, 2009, Alan Orlob hops off a plane in Jakarta, Indonesia. He is at the time Marriott's International Vice President for Global and Security. The next morning he gets up, he comes out of the shower, he hears an explosion. There's an explosion at the JW Marriott that's nearby. There's also an explosion at the Ritz-Carlton. And you write in the book, and I'd like you to explain this, quote, "The company's response was quick, decisive, and compassionate, but there was a problem." So explain what Marriott did right, but also where they might have veered off course.
What Marriott did right was they came out very quickly after the attacks. Mm-hmm. And the CEO of the company expressed his extreme concern for all the victims. It was a compassionate response. Mm-hmm. And he talked about his first concern was making sure that all of the guests in the hotel were well taken care of, that the victims were and their families were taken care of. But obviously, there were a lot of unanswered questions. And so companies often want to get in front of a story as fast as they possibly can, but they don't know all the facts. And so the risk in responding to a crisis is that you get too far out on your skis and you say something that turns out not to be true. And so then your customers and other stakeholders don't trust what it is that you're saying. So Marriott actually navigated this terrain quite skillfully, saying what they valued, what they cared about, without saying who they thought was responsible for the attacks, whether they had done anything wrong. They said that they wanted a full investigation to be done. So that they all did quite well. What the company didn't do well initially, but Alan Orlob actually saved the day on this, was to defend itself. So it turns out, and we talk about this in the book, that Marriott is one of the most secure hotel chains in the world. They take security very seriously. They have a round-the-clock security group led by Alan Orlob, who had a long career in special operations. Mm-hmm. They have a color-coded security system where they're constantly moving hotels up and down an alert level with very stringent security measures that are put in place when conditions warrant. And they do auditing of, sort of mystery shopper type auditing of these hotels to make sure that there's compliance with these security procedures. So at the time of the Jakarta attacks, the Marriott hotels that were hit were some of the most secure hotels in the country. And so what Alan Orlob did was he felt like Marriott was really getting slammed in the press, that they were at fault for a terrorist attack. Right. And so Orlob made the call on his own to actually give an interview to CNN. And it worked out quite well. And he explained on the ground that his determination to investigate what went wrong, but he also talked about what Marriott did to try to secure its hotels. That was a very important message. And after Orlob did that, that became much more of a standard operating procedure for Marriott.
Right. Now, Marriott has a very healthy advertising budget, Amy, but I don't think they're running ads saying that we are safer than Hyatt and Sheraton. We're better prepared. But this gets back to your concept about nobody gets credit for fixing problems that never happened.
Well, one other interesting lesson that we learned from the Marriott experience was Alan Orlob also discovered years ago when there was a terrorist attack at hotels in Amman, Jordan, Marriott was not hit in that attack. And mm-hmm. one of the suicide bomber's vests didn't go off, and she was interviewed. And she said, yeah, we cased Marriott, but it seemed too secure, so we hit some other hotels instead. Well, at first glance, you think in a competitive industry, this is good for Marriott hotels because they're more secure than other hotels. But what Orlob realized was that nobody wanted to go to Amman, Jordan after the terrorist attack. An attack on one was an attack on all. And so that really led him to create a working group of major hotel chain operators so that they could all benefit from sharing security practices. Businesses often don't think about banding together to share best practices, that can actually be a benefit to everybody. But that's one of the risk mitigation strategies that we talk about in the book.
Reading about Marriott, Amy, kind of whetted my appetite to learn more about Alan Orlob. I watch John Grisham movies about law firms, and every movie there's always some shady guy who's running security for the law firm. You don't know what his background is, but boy, he's just going to just do everything horrible to defend the law firm. So I was very curious about what Mr. Orlob's background was. Did he just, luck into this job? Was he somebody's idiot nephew? How did he get this job? And the answer was this. I went onto LinkedIn. He's actually on LinkedIn, and here's his description. I'll read it to you. Quote, "Prior to working for Marriott, Alan was the corporate security director for Al Ghanim International. Managing a close protection detail, he served with U.S. Army Special Forces, both active and reserve, for a total of 24 years. He is a former president of ISMA, the International Security Management Association. He is the chairman of the Orange County Homeland Security Advisory Council, an initiative with the Orange County, California Sheriff's Department. He has served as a consultant with the U.S. State Department's Anti-Terrorism Assistance Program on Hotel Security and was a stakeholder on a RAND initiative on counter-surveillance. In his role, he has consulted with several foreign governments on hotel security. This guy is steeped in security.
He is, and in the Jakarta attack that you mentioned, his special operations training kicked in. He ran toward the sound of the explosion. He ran away from it, right? That tells you a lot.
Right.
What we found is that in these sort of leading companies, they are hiring people with this kind of background, either military background, law enforcement background, intelligence background. And we often joke that government needs to be run more like a business. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to political risk, business often needs to be run more like a government with
right.
these kinds of capabilities to assess and to respond to risks in a more timely and systematic way.
You anticipated my next question was, are we going to see more corporations now hire people like Alan Orlop with this background? Would this be a natural segue for especially military people maybe looking at that 20-year junction where they want to get out of the military and segue into the private sector? This would seem a natural fit for a lot of people.
I think we're seeing a lot of that, but I don't want to leave the impression that it's just about sort of the hard security guns and gates types of challenges. That what companies really need to do today is not only cover that, but think about the risks around the corner.
Right.
Whether it's United Airlines is one of the examples we use in the book, where when there's a passenger dragged off the airplane, that's not about guards and guns and gates. That's about your reputation.
Mm-hmm.
That's about a viral video of a passenger being treated horribly. So mm-hmm. companies need to hire folks that have a wide range of skill sets to be able to identify risks that they may not naturally see, and to think about a variety of ways in which they can meet those risks.
Let's talk about another ripple effect, which would be other business schools around America, primarily Stanford's competitors, Wharton and Harvard. Are you seeing those schools also getting into global risk? Is that conversation? In other words, are we going to look for future MBA candidates who have more of a world vision as part of their education?
Of course, I'm Stanford through and through, so I'd say nobody's as ahead of the curve as Stanford is.
But no, if this is the new reality of being an international corporation, you obviously want to have MBAs who have some background, so it would seem that this
absolutely
needs to be taught.
Yes, and so there are professors at Wharton that are teaching in this mm-hmm. area. One of the things when Condi and I went on book tour, we wanted to go and talk at business schools because we think it's a really important area and that all leading institutions that are training the next generation of business executives really need to be thinking about not just the economic risks, which are sort of typical for business leaders to think about, but these political risks.
Right. Let's shift gears for a moment. This is Tuesday here in Northern California. It's Starbucks Day around America. Starbucks, if you haven't been following the news, has a big problem on its hands. It involves an incident that occurred in Philadelphia where two black men were picked up and kicked out of Starbucks. The manager wanted them gone. It created a very uncomfortable question about racial profiling at Starbucks, which then got a question about loitering at Starbucks. So today, Amy, nationwide, 180,000 Starbucks employees are receiving a quote-unquote toolkit, which focuses on understanding racial bias, the history of public accommodations in the United States. Starbucks around the country, I think there are like 9,000 of them, mm-hmm. are going to close for 4 hours and have a conversation about this to basically create a better Starbucks, which we will then see presumably tomorrow. It's not global risk, if you will. It's not terrorism or some horrible threat like that. But it does seem to me the same principle that you're writing about in the book, which is analyzing a situation, responding to a situation. And in some regards with Starbucks, should Starbucks have anticipated this?
Yeah, so I think Starbucks' reaction is one that really does follow some of the best practices of what happens when you're facing a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So initially, they were a little slow to get off the dime. But the company quickly turned it around and did so in a variety of ways. Number one, led with values. It's
right.
one of the key messages we say when you're dealing with a crisis. Say what you stand for and why.
Mm-hmm.
And so the CEO said very clearly, this is not acceptable. And then he put his money where his mouth is, quite literally, right? Closing thousands of Starbucks stores for an afternoon. It may not eliminate the racial bias problem, but it sure sends a very loud message that company cares. that it's investing the time and it's investing the resources. And it made a very public commitment to do better. The second thing that Starbucks did was they actually changed the policy, right? So before, there was a lot of discretion involved about who could use the bathroom, when they could use the bathroom, whether you need to buy something at Starbucks or not. I confess I have spent many an afternoon at my kids' water polo tournaments doing my work in a Starbucks, and I bought a couple of things, but certainly not enough to justify my presence there for several hours.
Right.
So now there's a consistent policy, because what you don't want is you don't want managers to have so much discretion that this unconscious racism kicks into gear. So I think those are all good reactions that the company took. Are they likely to see more problems? It's a large organization with lots of employees. There's always going to be somebody who's a weak link in when it comes to customer service.
Okay, so the question is, should a company like Starbucks, like a Marriott, like a FedEx, should they be having somebody in their war room anticipating what can go wrong next at a Starbucks?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So, and again, you don't, when we went to one of our book tours, one of the faculty members who's a friend of ours said, you know, I think that you need to have a recommendation that companies need to hire more political scientists, right? That's not what we're advocating, though. But it does take just a little bit of time and a little bit of imagination to say, what are the alternatives here? I'll tell you one sort of quick and dirty, back of the envelope practice that one of the investors we talked to said he does is he asks, and he has everyone in his organization ask the simple question, what if we're wrong? If you just pause to ask that question about every investment decision you make, you're likely to surface some alternative scenarios that will then better prepare you for the surprises around the corner.
Interesting. Interesting. I do know some corporations have turned toward political thinkers to get out of their situations. Uber is a good example of this, Amy. Uber, a couple years ago, hired a fellow named Chris Lehane. Chris Lehane worked in the Clinton White House with a fellow named Mark Fabiano. They were called the so-called Masters of Disaster because they handled the public relations for the Clinton impeachment saga. And after the Clinton White House shut down, they moved out to California, Fabiano in Los Angeles, Lehane in San Francisco, and they ran what is euphemistically called strategic communications, but is in fact crisis communications. Uber hired Mr. Lehane because Uber realized that it had a big image mess on its hands and wanted somebody who thought strategically and politically to get its way out of that situation. So maybe other companies will take that model moving forward.
Well, the interesting thing with Uber, I think, is that now Uber's in the position where they have a very different mission statement. They've talked about cleaning house. They
had this. CEO is all over TV right now talking about this.
Yep. Yeah. They had this investigation by Eric Holder.
Right.
They brought in Tony West, general counsel, who I joked with him recently, you know, why did you take this job? You had the dream job at Pepsi and, you know, and nothing says exciting like like taking the job at Uber. Mm-hmm. And so the challenge that Uber faces now is that their success has been built on taking aggressive risks
right.
to go into emerging markets, to really find places where the law is gray. They had a very aggressive strategy. And so how is it that you fix Uber's very serious problems without being the Debbie Downer in every conversation that they shouldn't be taking risks?
Right.
Right? And so that's particular to Uber, but it's true for all companies. What we don't want to say in the book, what we don't say in the book, is that you should never take risks. You have to take risks if you're a company. But the challenge is taking smart risks so you understand that the reward that you're going to get for taking the risks, mm-hmm. right? So one example we have in the book is an investor who said, you know, I'm going to invest in a intellectual property, and we have suspicions that this IP is going to be stolen within a period of time. The question is, do we go into this country? And the ultimately, they decided that they were going to go in because they thought their estimates were it would take about 10 years before that IP would basically be stolen or used in a way that it wouldn't be worth anything. And in that 10 years, they could recoup their investment and returns that made sense. So it didn't stop them from taking risks, but they made smarter decisions about where to take those mm-hmm. risks.
You're a basketball fan. Are you also a football fan?
Yes.
Okay. Help me make sense of what the NFL has done lately.
Well, the NFL has just, I'm going to use a terrible pun, punted on the big challenge that they have with the
right.
president and the kneeling of the national anthem. This problem is not going to go away.
Right.
What's likely going to happen is now they're going to get into a Twitter feud with the president of the United States about who's in the locker room and who's not in the locker room when the
right.
anthem is being played at NFL games. The NFL is really facing three challenges at the same time. One is the national anthem, which became a problem when the president injected himself into the conversation. conversation. Mm-hmm. And there are great benefits for the president. There's only downside for the NFL owners caught between the players and the president and their fans. The second problem the NFL faces is the concussion problem.
Right.
And then the third problem is that they have declining ratings. And the decline in ratings on TV, it's nearly 20% in the past 3 years, predates the anthem controversy. So they've got all three of these things converging at the same time. There's no easy way out for the NFL.
No, not at all. The news today, besides Starbucks, is also ABC and Roseanne. And I don't know how closely you follow Roseanne Barr or not. Roseanne Barr gave a positively bizarre racist tweet last night, and in less than 24 hours, ABC canceled her show. Not an easy decision for ABC because her show was very popular. It was a moneymaker, but they decided that she must go. Is this a lesson we're seeing that speed is of the essence in these decisions?
Absolutely. And so we're seeing this because things can go viral so quickly. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to wait 3 days or 5 days. You saw Mark Zuckerberg really get raked over the coals for taking several days to respond over the Cambridge Analytica scandal.
Right.
And so speed is of the essence. And so you need to be able, again, to respond quickly, but not so rashly that you're providing false information. The other thing we're seeing is that consumer activism with boycotts, right, whether and Twitter hashtags are becoming very powerful tools of individuals and small groups. And so we see this on the national security front. We often talk about the threat environment and how if you think about the diffusion of capabilities to non-state actors like terrorist groups or lone individuals, it's a different threat world in the national security space than it was 20 years ago.
Right.
Same thing is true for businesses dealing with political risks. One person or a group of people can now have outsized impact on a corporate bottom line. So ABC was taking fast action, I think, to try to head off any of that kind of controversy.
Okay, I'm not going to give you the luxury of 10-year planning, not having to react to a crisis or a bad situation, but planning 10 years ahead, Amy. And that is the Olympics in 2028 in your former city, Los Angeles. Maybe you'll be there watching your children playing water polo. I don't know. But the city of Los Angeles, the United States Olympic Committee, the IOC have 10 years to figure out how to pull off the Summer Games in Los Angeles in a very complicated world, complicated by terrorism. So you, Amy Ziegart, are tasked with helping them put together risk analysis and risk management. What does Los Angeles need to be thinking 10 years out?
Wow, what a great question. So I'd say what I would want to do is create a process. I wouldn't have all the answers. I wouldn't presume to have all the answers. But
right.
really good risk management companies get different minds together to
right.
spur that creative thinking. So I'd want to put a process in place to think about what are all the things that we should be thinking about.
Right.
The two that are top of mind at first blush are terrorism, obviously, mm-hmm. and cybersecurity threats that could have a debilitating effect on the Olympics and cascade effects in other...
Describe that. Somebody would simply hack the games?
You can imagine someone hacking the games. You can imagine someone turning off the power. You could imagine, and for a variety of motives, right?
Right.
To show off that they can, because there's a nation state that was caught doping and wanted to wreak havoc in the games. Not mentioning names, and we can all think about what country that might be. That it's an opportunity while the eyes are focused on the Olympics to penetrate and test some other systems in the United States,
right.
to send a message to the United States that we're vulnerable. So you can imagine a whole host of different nefarious scenarios. So I know you didn't know this, Bill, but I will share with you, the first year we taught the political risk class, we actually did a simulation in advance of the London Olympics. And it was that the Director of National Intelligence had credible information that there was going to be a terrorist attack on, believe it or not, on Starbucks in London. That was the example that we used.
That was the hypothetical.
That was a hypothetical,
okay.
purely hypothetical. And so we tasked our class with figuring out what would you do. And one of the key takeaways from that was that you have to be very careful because the more you harden the target, the more you scare away the customer.
Correct.
So how do you balance between those things? And then how do you work with government so that, because companies can't do it on their own. So if I were queen of the world for a day and advising the city of Los Angeles about how to make sure there is a good Olympics without any of these kinds of challenges, I'd say that the conversation between major private sector players and the government, local, state, and federal, those conversations can't happen soon enough. Because if you're just exchanging business cards in the moment of a crisis, you've waited far too long.
Interesting. What is the relationship, Amy, between government and business, looking in the near future? We talk about business wanting to establish in some insecure parts of the world. Do they need to go to the federal government and ask for help or cooperation? Should they turn to the government for intelligence? Do they do their own intelligence? How do the two mingle?
So again, it depends on the industry. I would say that businesses should not be relying on just the government for their intelligence, because they're the good risk leaders or managers in the business world are very proactive about pulsing a variety of sources for intelligence information.
Give me some examples.
So there's one example of the shooting down of the Malaysian Airlines plane over Ukraine.
Right.
And there were a number of airlines that were running commercial flights over Ukraine for a long time. And the airspace was not shut down beforehand. The question is why? Mm-hmm. Well, not every airline actually flew over eastern Ukraine. Two airlines didn't, Qantas and Korean Air. And one of the things that these two airlines realized is they needed to get information from not just the government. So why would the government of Ukraine not shut down its airspace if, in fact, it was unsafe to fly? And there's lots of evidence suggesting that the government of Ukraine knew it was unsafe to fly. Well, if you shut down your airspace, there are a couple things that happen. Number one, the government doesn't get the overflight payments, right? So there's a financial incentive to keep the airspace open. And number two, when you shut down airspace, it says we don't have sovereignty over our territory.
Right.
So there's a real political incentive for governments to delay as long as possible that decision to shut down their airspace. And so if you're only waiting for information coming from the Ukrainian government through the American government to you, if you're an airline, you could be waiting too long. So good companies need to understand they need to be much more forward thinking about where they're getting information from and have their own sources on the ground.
So who do I hire my business in to get intelligence? Do I look to former intelligence officials? Do I look for certain companies in the United States that do intelligence work, if you will, or studying foreign countries? Where should I go?
So there's no one right model.
Mm-hmm.
Many companies outsource and hire consultants on a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. I think the best model, not that there's one perfect model, but the best companies typically have their in-house capabilities in conjunction with experts that they call in to lend insight into particular areas. Because again, if it's just the risk folks that are thinking about these issues and it's not integrated into the business, you're not going to do very well as a company. Everyone's got to feel that they own the risk and that there's a business case for understanding and mitigating and dealing with the risk.
This is not related to the book, but I'd feel bad for not asking you since I have your attention right now. I've been reading the Amy Chosick book on the Hillary Clinton campaign. I don't know if you've read it or not. She's the New York Times reporter who followed Hillary for about a decade. So she talked about her relationship with Hillary. It's sort of like the Julia and Julie book in some regards. She desperately wants a relationship with Hillary, and it's just not there, and it's very personal at times. But one thing which stood out in the book, Amy, as I was reading it, was she talks about how the leaks came out, all the Clinton emails are released toward the end of the campaign, and the chaos this causes. What caught my attention, Amy, was she said, at first we didn't know where it was coming from. We didn't know if it was Russia or some other country. Here we are 2 years after that election almost. Have we really figured out what happened that fall?
No, we haven't. And there are a couple reasons why that is. It's a very complicated tale, as we all know, and news comes out every day. The person who has the greatest visibility into what happened at this point is the one person who's not talking at all, and that's Bob Mueller.
Bob Mueller.
And so there's that. But there's also a more fundamental problem, which is attribution is hard in cyberspace. I know there's a big debate among cyber experts about how hard attribution is. Mm-hmm. Fast attribution is actually pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really notable, I think, that in January of 2017, the intelligence community came out with an assessment. Right? It was the CIA, the National Security Agency, and the FBI. And they all agreed that there was a highly directed, as in from the Kremlin, effort for Russia to disrupt the American election. And that judgment was made with high confidence.
Right.
Now, those are very special words in the intelligence community. They don't use high confidence all that often. But the question about exactly how far flung was Russia's effort, what, if anything, was the role of WikiLeaks,
right,
what was the role of Facebook? Every sort of month, we're getting an expanded view of just how widespread the Russian information warfare campaign was. Mm. So it's very difficult to try to understand the sort of sprawling nature of the Russian enterprise. And then, of course, there's the question about what exactly was the nature of the relationship between those in the Trump campaign and the Russian government. And we still don't know the answers to many key questions, but we sure know there were an awful lot of meetings with an awful lot of Russians.
Right. So my concern is each month we seem not to have an answer to what happened, and each month, Amy, we're getting closer to the next election, which begs the question, is this going to happen in 2020?
Well, the Russians haven't left. Right. They're still here.
Yes.
And so, you know, we haven't even stopped the gaps from the last election. I will say this, you know, we cyber experts have spent a lot of time thinking about election security. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of problems. The problem we should least worry about is tampering the votes on election day, right? What we should be more worried about is suppressing the vote. So efforts through social media platforms to dissuade voters from showing up at the polls,
right,
or efforts to hack into election rolls where you show up, Bill, and they say, well, we don't have you on our rolls. You have to come back. And of course, elections are one of the only areas where you can't come back tomorrow. Right. If there's a cyber attack on a bank, you can go when the bank reopens. If there's a cyber attack on election day, you can't say come back tomorrow or next week. It has to be on that day.
Right.
And so we are woefully ill-prepared for our cybersecurity for the 2018 elections and the Russians. And by the way, now other non-state actors have the Russian playbook. Can use the Russian information warfare playbook to really sow massive distrust and exacerbate the wedge between different groups of Americans. And it's very concerning.
Have you thought about mailing 50 copies of your book to the nation's 50 state election officials?
I'm glad you mentioned it. I'll have to encourage them to buy it at Costco or on Amazon.com.
I mean, there's something to be said about risk preparation here.
Absolutely. Part of the problem, as you know, Bill, is that election systems are handled by the states.
Right.
And the states sure don't want the federal government to interfere too much in what they're doing. It is a state-based prerogative. Now, some have said that because there's so many different types of election systems, that means that we're secure. I don't subscribe to that belief.
No.
There are many states that have online voting that do not have paper audit ballot so that you can see if you voted that they actually tabulated in the right way.
Right.
These include battleground states. Some of our biggest battleground states actually don't have a way to verify that how we think we voted is how we actually voted. And if that's the case, you can imagine how insecure our voter rolls are as well. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of work to do, and we are nowhere close to plugging all these gaps.
Good. What are you writing next for Atlantic?
What I'm writing next for Atlantic is a piece about the nuclear summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, what the good news is and what the bad news is.
Well, you think it's going to happen?
I think it's likely to happen. Likely. It feels to me like a sort of mad scramble for a Vegas show opening night,
it's
right?
It's about 2 weeks away now, right?
It feels like 20 seconds away, I'm
yes.
sure, if you're planning the summit. And there's some good news here, right? The good news is that there are experts now negotiating. So Trump is not going to be the negotiator in chief. That's the correct thing to do. These are very technical and challenging issues.
Right.
And so they're putting in place an expert team. The Japanese are now involved. That's a good thing, too. Because
he's going to talk to Abe, apparently, before the summit.
Right. And so Japan has very serious equities involved. Our nuclear umbrella covers not just South Korea, but Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Our forces in the Korean Peninsula are there not just for South Korea, but for the region. And so involving Japan in these negotiations is critical. And Abe is, of course, very sober when it comes to his assessment of the North Korean regime. And so that's good for the president to hear before he goes to Singapore.
Right.
The other piece of good news is that John Bolton's been surprisingly quiet in the past few days. He hasn't been talking about the Libya model,
right,
which got us into this trouble to begin with.
The vice president added to that.
The vice president
well.
Put
yes.
fuel on that fire.
Yes.
And so the fact that we're actually continuing the conversation, I think we often forget that just a few months ago, it looked like we were headed to military conflict with North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And so this kind of high-level dialogue, and I hope that the summit is actually talks about talks, that it opens the door to continuing engagement.
Right.
That kind of dialogue is crucial, not just for reducing tension, but for generating insight, right? Insight about the North Korean regime, how it thinks, what it knows, how it perceives us. We don't know much about the Hermit Kingdom. It's called the Hermit Kingdom for a reason.
Yes.
And so I think that that's all good news. The bad news is that we could rush into a deal where Trump gets played by Kim Jong-un, as three presidents before him have, that it feels like we have a deal, and then the North Koreans renege on that deal once international pressure, economic pressure is lifted. That's risk number one. And risk number two is that President Trump is deluded by President Trump. That he gets so optimistic about whatever denuclearization means, when those hopes will be dashed, which they inevitably will, because it has to be a long process. It's a technical and difficult process that we don't know what the president will do next.
A lot of risk.
A lot of high risk, high reward.
High risk, high reward. Speaking of which, how do the United States, the government of North Korea and the government of Singapore, how do they prepare for this? How do they manage the risk of putting these two gentlemen in the same city at the same time?
Well, what they should have done and what we haven't done is we should have had a long and quiet series of negotiations before this. This is, as you know from your experiences, this is kind of backwards of how it normally goes. Usually there's all the spade work that's done very quietly, and everyone knows what the communique is going to say when the two leaders get together for the photo op. Now we have photo op first and the spade work second. This is not the optimal way to prepare for a summit. So I think they're dealing with the best situation they can. Of course, the challenge coin, I don't know if you saw the challenge coin that the White House put out, celebrating the summit that may or may not happen, was not a wise move.
They had, they pulled that back, didn't they?
They did.
They have to put it out again, I guess.
Well, or they could break it in half and have the two sides piece them together if and when they do meet in Singapore.
I'll make it a second mint collection, I don't know. Amy Ziegart, enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to download, and have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, please sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Amy Ziegart and her Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Dr. Amy B. Ziegart is on Twitter, and her Twitter handle is, surprisingly enough, @AmyZiegart. You spell that @AmyZiegart, @AmyZiegart. The book she co-authored with Dr. Cutter and Lisa Rice is Political Risk, How Businesses and Organizations Can Anticipate Global Security. Yes, it's on Amazon.com. There's an entire Amy B. Ziegart page at Amazon.com where you'll find several of her remarkable books on the CIA, the FBI, and origins of 9/11, the evolution of the CIA, the JCS, and the NSC. You like alphabet soup.
It's a lot of acronyms.
That is. Anything else we need to promote while we've got you here?
No, but thank you. I would swear that you're related to me.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. I'm Chris Dower for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.